Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading articles from the October issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Miranda Lambert. The country superstar is riding high with new tunes, an upcoming Vegas residency, and inspired forays into home goods and Western fashion. By Joe Layden. Back in 2011, I drove 100 miles through the snow to interview Miranda Lambert. No kidding. She was in Dallas for a photo shoot, and I was on my way there from Houston when the flakes began to fall. First slowly, then seriously. Naturally, I drove as cautiously as possible. Just as naturally, my editor called periodically to make sure that I was safe, and, more important, that I would get there on time. Lambert laughed as we shared that memory recently. "Yeah, I remember that. I love it." And she laughed even harder when I reminded her that I wasn't just a fan, I was a Ran fan. And I still had the nickname branded koozie I picked up at her 2009 CMA Festival meet and greet to prove it. Truth to tell, it's all a pleasure to talk with this contagiously upbeat, unabashedly feisty, and terrifically multi-talented lady. But we agreed that, all things considered, we would do our catching up for this story over the phone. We reconnected earlier this year, not so long after the release of her new album, Palomino, the announcement of her upcoming Las Vegas residency, the launch of her Walmart line of home essentials, and her appearance on Time Magazine's annual list of the world's most influential people. Here are highlights from our conversation, edited for brevity and clarity. CNI. I'm holding in my hand right now, because I'm one of the OG people who still do print media, Time Magazine. Congratulations. Miranda, thank you so much. And I notice that you're listed not under artists or pioneers, but innovators. I saw that, and actually, when I first got the article, I was trying to look through to find myself on the list, and I went straight to artists, of course, and then I saw I was listed as an innovator, and I was like, that's interesting. Well, do you agree with the description? It's hard to say about yourself, honestly. I'm not sure what the explanation for that description is. I'm very flattered, obviously, and I don't know. I think I try to be an innovator, so I guess I accept that. Ellie King writes in her essay for the magazine that you've been very outspoken and innovative in raising the profile of female country artists. Yeah, and I take that very seriously to heart. If we don't fight for us, who's going to? So I feel in that way I've definitely tried to be an innovator, and I keep trying daily to think of new ways that I can be of help to any artist, but especially a female singer-songwriter. When you pick this job, you pick it for your life, and it's a commitment, and there's a lot of sacrifice that goes with it. So having a network where we can bounce things off each other is so much more helpful than trying to navigate it on your own. Do you remember the first time you encountered sexism in the industry and the thought formed in your mind that, uh-oh, this is going to be part of the package? Yeah. I think I got my first taste of it when I was trying to get booked into gigs. I'm 17, I'm writing songs, and my mom's trying to get my gigs booked, and the bar owners would all say the same thing. We don't book girls, they don't draw. And so I had to fight that battle from day one of wanting to do this for my career. And proving them wrong is what I'm still doing to this day, which is great. But it was definitely not easy, an easy way to start out with. No one really giving you a good shake, a fair start. You mentioned your mom, and that reminds me of something we talked about years ago. While you were growing up, You had a mom and a dad who were private investigators, and while you were at the dinner table, they sometimes talked about the bad behavior of the people they investigated. Did this help you prepare for dealing with people who were, shall we say, impediments? Absolutely. I think the table talk around our house was not your conventional conversation over spaghetti and meatballs, but I think that's also where I gathered a lot of my early information for songwriting. I mean, at 17, how much have you lived to really be able to write about? So I absorbed a lot of information for my craft, and I still do. People say, "What's your biggest inspiration?" And I'm like, "Life." You also mentioned that those conversations with Mom and Dad made you cautious about whom you should trust. Do you find it easier to trust people these days? I think a little bit, yeah. I think that comes with age and experience and getting a little more comfortable in your own skin. It's like I'm pretty much able to read people right off the bat. So I feel like I've been able to surround myself with really, really great people. I credit a lot of that to my success to the people around me for always leading me in the right direction and supporting me on the right things, and it's very helpful. There must be some days when you're on tour or when you're recording and you wake up and think, "I wouldn't like to do this today. I really like to stay in bed." Or, "I would really not like to go out tonight." When that happens, how do you rev up your engine? Well, after 20 years of doing it, you can't love it every day. True enough. But you know, that what helps me the most is being able to miss it. I think that downtime is so important, and I learned a lot more about that during 2020 because I was forced to rest and take a break with no options. I learned to settle into that and then ended up writing 3 records. So I learned about myself and thought, okay, I'm way better at my job when I take a minute away from it so that I can miss it. And then I can regroup and balance out my life stuff and my work stuff. For the first 6 months of the pandemic, I probably didn't write anything. And like I say, when I ended up writing 3 records. So it just showed me it's important to balance things. That's the most important thing for me now. Now I know this is like asking you who's your favorite child or something like that. But in the course of a concert, what are maybe the 3 songs you most look forward to performing for a live audience? Not necessarily your best songs or your best known songs, but every night these are going to be on the song list, and you're really looking forward to playing these. There's always a new one that keeps us fresh. Like right now, If I Was a Cowboy is on my set list, and it's my first single from Palomino, and I get excited to sing that. And when Little Red Wagon comes up on the set, I'm like, yeah, it's here. Because it's just fun, and especially the kids, if there are kids in the audience, they just love it. It's just fun, a fun, feel-good song. And then I guess in the same vein, we've been ending our shows with Drunk, which is my single with Ellie Keen. And it's just such an anthem, and it brings people so much joy, and you just can't help but jump up and down. And the whole crowd starts jumping up and down, too. It's like, okay, the show's over, but we had the best time because we always do it last. I've been enjoying that. Are Kerosene and Gunpowder and Lead still part of your set list? Absolutely. Those are the kinds of songs that are staples. So they're in there. I can't get away from them, and I'm not tired of them yet. Kerosene, for sure. It's like the OG. It started this whole ball rolling. Well, it'd be like if you were Mick Jagger and you tried to get away with not singing Satisfaction. Exactly. That's not going to work. But do you notice that some of the women in the audience seem to whoop and holler a bit louder during those 2 than maybe some of the other ones? Those 2 are Mama's Broken Heart. We had to move that one in the set list because we had it right after The House That Built Me. Or right before The House That Built Me, actually. And the girls always get in fights. And I have to wait and start my ballad because they'd have to calm down from Mama's broken heart. So we moved it down into what we call the final push, which is Mama's Broken Heart, Gunpowder and Lead, Little Red Wagon, and Drunk. We do this final push at the end of the show, so if the girls were fighting, they could just fight through the rest of the set. Can you tell us a little bit about your new Walmart brand of entertaining essentials and home decor? It's called the Wanda June. It's named after my mom, Beverly June Lambert, and my grandmother, her mom, Wanda Louise Coker. Basically, the whole concept started because I was having memories of hand-me-down china and cocktail sets and things that my mom treasures that were my grandma's and that were her grandma's. And so when we started working on the concept, it was like, let's make this really about things that can be collectible for mothers and daughters and grandmothers for years to come. We wanted to get that feeling of nostalgia back. And it's been so much fun to put it together. I just sat with the guys that are going to design it, and we talked about what was important to me about my family and my memories. And I think a lot of the best memories are made around the dinner table. So that's what we based the whole Wanda June line on. You have a Las Vegas residency coming up in September. Do you see this as a milestone in your career, like something you've been actively working toward or a benchmark? I don't think that I was working towards it necessarily until it came along, if that makes any sense. And I'm like, oh, this feels right at the exact time. When you tour for 20 years, it's like they've seen you. So you have to sometimes take a little bit of a step back to make people miss you. But how do you still pay your people and work and all that kind of stuff? Vegas came at just exactly the right time for me because, number one, how cool it is that the party comes to me for once. I've been going to the parties for all these years, so I'm very excited about that. I'm very excited to be a part of what Vegas is and what it represents for people. It's a complete escape. And I just feel like the tone's already set. Like the shows in Vegas, you know that it's going to be fun. So I'm really excited. We're right in the middle of the creative process right now, and it's been cool to put together because I can take it up a notch from anything I've ever done on the road. I'm having fun figuring that out, and I'm very nervous about it. It's something completely different for me not to get off the bus and go play a show. I may have to just ride my bus out there for the first show, just so I feel normal. Or keep them parked right outside. Exactly. But I'm super pumped about it, and every one of the artist friends that I have that have done Vegas residencies speaks so highly of it, so I know it's going to be fun. For more information on Miranda Lambert's new music, her Las Vegas residency, and her home and fashion lines, visit MirandaLambert.com. Utopia in the Desert. Arizona's Castle Hot Springs has long been a desert hideaway, famous for its hot springs and remote location. Newly renovated, the oasis has transformed into a luxurious wellness hotspot. By Layla Najathi. This is where it all begins, said our driver as we began the 15-mile drive up a windy and rocky dirt road that was more suggestive of an off-roading trail than the entrance to a wellness resort. We were enveloped by jagged mountains and a sea of funny-looking cacti that peered out from the Sonoran Desert in Morristown, Arizona, about an hour north of the Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport. There was no sign of civilization. Every few miles, a grimy 4x4 would drive past us, causing a cloud of dust that flung small rocks against the side of the SUV. So it seemed unlikely that a luxury resort would be tucked anywhere close. It seemed like the middle of nowhere. We drove past a private mine, and I caught a few glimpses of the 10,000-acre Lake Pleasant Regional Park, an outdoor playground for water sports enthusiasts. But I couldn't help wondering where these legendary hot springs were going to appear from. About 20 minutes and several bumps later, we turned a corner and Shangri-La finally emerged. A row of towering palm trees stood tall against the rugged Bradshaw Mountains, surrounded by 1,100 acres of lush, verdant grounds, a tranquil pond, and 30 standalone bungalows. The gates swung open and we drove down the palm tree-lined citrus drive. I rolled down my window and stuck my head out to get a whiff of the perfumed air of fresh lemons and orange blossoms. I could hear the relaxing sound of birds chirping as I gazed at butterflies fluttering, and all my senses were starting to slowly awaken. This was the moment I learned that Castle Hot Springs was more than just a wellness resort. It was utopia. The closer we got to the resort, the farther my daily worries felt. The only thing I was thinking about was what time they'd serve dinner. I was welcomed with a refreshing fuchsia-colored tea made with fresh hibiscus grown on the farm. The organic farm spreads across 3 acres in front of the lodge, the resort's main building, which houses the check-in desk, Bar 1896, and Harvest, the resort's only restaurant. Before I checked into my room, I was whisked away for a farm tour with resident agronomist Ian Berger. A fifth-generation Arizonian, Berger studied agriculture at the University of Arizona and is now the mastermind behind the resort's farm. He also has a personal connection to Castle Hot Springs. His great-great-grandfather, Richard E. Sloan, was the last territorial governor of Arizona, and the resort figured into the social milieu way back during his tenure. Castle Hot Springs was a big deal in the territory days, Berger said. It was the wintertime territorial capital of Arizona for a bit. It was pretty big during that time, so my great-great-grandfather frequented here, and they used to spend Christmas here. My great-grandma, we have her on video talking about playing in the spring. My family definitely had a long-standing history here. The farm is a new addition to the resort. Irrigated from the property's well and even the hot spring's water, the lush farm might be unexpected in this remote desert spot, but the dedicated flavor farmers cultivate and harvest seasonally more than 1,000 varieties of fruits, vegetables, herbs, and florals, including their own tomato varieties. From juicy Caracara navel oranges to badger flame beets, this fresh bounty would make its way into our freshly squeezed carrot and ginger juice in the morning, the comforting Tom Kha Gai soup at lunch, and every farm-to-fork, five-course tasting menu I would have during my stay. During the tour, Berger plucked a small green leaf from the garden and handed it to me. He took a bite, implying that it was my turn to try, and asked me to guess what it was. To my surprise, the sweet-tasting leaf is what we know as stevia, or what I like to call Mother Nature's candy. Berger had an acute awareness of the garden as he paced up and down the beds, pointing out edible succulents and eagerly sharing random gardening tidbits, like the fact that coriander seeds originated from cilantro flowers. It made perfect sense for any guest to begin their wellness journey at the farm, the heart and soul of the resort. It's grounding to see how things are done on the farm, see where the food you're eating comes from, and taste things in the field, Berger said. We provide the best quality fruits, vegetables, and herbs to the kitchen, the bar, and ultimately our guests. but on a larger scale, we're a central point in the resort and set the standard for sustainability. We really are trying to drive it to a more grounded place. It's the root of the resort in some ways. Obviously, the springs are why we're all here, but we're trying to elevate everything. The springs have been the main attraction since the resort originally opened in 1896. Castle Hot Springs was a hideaway for presidents and tycoons, including the Rockefellers and Vanderbilts, who frequented the resort for its hot springs, which range from 106 to 86 degrees Fahrenheit and are said to have medicinal properties. But in 1976, a fire broke out and destroyed the main administration building, now called the Lodge, and caused the iconic resort to fall dormant for about 40 years. In 2014, a husband and wife acquired the resort and spent nearly 5 years rebuilding and preserving the original infrastructure as much as possible. Like a phoenix, Castle Hot Springs rose from the ashes in 2019 as the remote retreat that's making all the impressive travel hot lists. Credit not just the setting and the redo, but also the all-inclusive, adults-only experience with its slew of wellness classes and outdoor adventures. You can hide yourself away in this exclusive and intimate enclave, or you can be going and doing throughout the day. Yoga, meditation, sound baths, hiking, bike riding, mixology, archery, e-bikes, and a custom-built Via Ferrata with a 200-foot aerial walkway, not for the faint of heart, are just a few of the many adventure-driven and mindfulness activities on offer, many of which are led by wellness curator and guru Colleen Inman. I had spent nearly 24 hours on the property, but hadn't yet discovered the historic geothermal waters that I'd heard so much about. I decided to wake up early the next day and spend the morning desert soaking. A 5-minute walk toward the back of the resort led me to the first and largest of the three springs. A stunning emerald green pool of water with reflections of the soaring palm trees appeared almost like a fortuitous tropical jungle hidden amid an arid desert. Further up, I came across a set of lockers, bathrooms, and other guest amenities. Walking up a few stairs, I passed the second cascading spring. Finally, the third, and most extraordinary, natural spring appeared. It was enclosed with rocks covered in vivid green moss, beautiful striations of black and green hues caused by the minerals over time, and the calming sounds of water running. I was lucky enough to have the hot springs to myself, even though I was told the resort was nearly sold out. I spent the next hour soaking in the warm water, surrounded by nothing but nature's beauty. As I took turns dipping in the adjacent springs, it was hard to ignore the history and legends that had passed through and soaked in this very same hot spring. If only these rocks could tell stories. The healing properties of the mineral-rich springs and the contagious stillness of the mountains were enough to make me overlook the fact that the wellness resort didn't actually have spa facilities. Mother Nature was the restorative space I didn't know I needed. On my last day, I had a Castle Hot Springs signature massage booked in one of the outdoor private cabanas set up alongside the creek, where the sounds of nature and flowing water were the soundtrack that instantly made me fall in and out of a deep, meditative sleep. During my stay at Castle Hot Springs, it seemed like time had frozen. For a few lovely days, I was transported into a desert oasis where my mind was as clear as the blue skies and my heart was open to receiving whatever this magical place would teach me. We aim to find tranquility, Colleen had said during our meditation, and tranquil is exactly how I left Castle Hot Springs. For more on Castle Hot Springs Resort, visit castlehotsprings.com. To get recipes for carrot, gold carrot and ginger juice, honey roasted carrot appetizers, and Tom Kha Gai soup, visit cowboysandindians.com.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading archive articles from True West Magazine, October 1979 edition. Bat Masterson's rescue of Bully Bill. He didn't particularly like Billy Thompson, but he liked his brother Ben, and what's a friend for? By Robert K. DeArmond. Explanatory note. In January 1880, Bat Masterson took two prisoners to the Leavenworth Prison, his last official act as sheriff of Fort County, Kansas. It is significant that noted gunfighters like Ben Thompson and Doc Holliday had not displayed their lethal prowess in Dodge City during Sheriff Masterson's tenure. Wyatt Earp, to whom Holliday was devoted, may be given credit for the good behavior of the deadly dentist during 1878 to 1879, but Thompson's uncharacteristic pacifism while in Dodge can be traced directly to his friendship with Masterson. They had known each other at Sweetwater, later known as Mobeety, in the Texas Panhandle. Living in Ford County were many respectable people, businessmen, merchants, farmers, and ranchers, who liked Bat personally, but objected to some of his friends. They found it difficult to understand how a man sworn to uphold the law could be on close terms with known outlaws and killers, men like the Thompson brothers, Ben and Billy. They did not hold with Bat's belief that a man should not be bothered as long as he behaved himself. Actually, Bat never did like Bill Thompson, but he was seen with him frequently because Bill stuck close to his older brother. Bat also disliked Doc Holliday and shunned him when possible. He tolerated him only because of his admiration for Wyatt Earp, Doc's friend and benefactor. In January 1880, Bat was 26 years old. He had been kicking around on the frontier for 8 years and had developed skills as a buffalo hunter, Indian scout, and peace officer. During these 8 years, however, a great change had taken place in the plains country he knew. By 1880, the buffalo were gone from Kansas and the Texas Panhandle. A few good herds still roamed Montana territory, but Bat knew their slaughter was imminent. The halcyon days of the hide hunter were over, never to return. The Plains Indians were a defeated race and did not pose a threat to the white man's westward expansion. Consequently, the services of government scouts were no longer in demand. It seemed to Bat as if the frontier that had trained him had changed so drastically and quickly that at 26, he was already an anachronism. Bat had learned one other skill, however, to which he now could turn for a good livelihood. He was a gambler, and a good one. Dodge City had entertained some of the most successful high rollers on the circuit in the hectic years 78 and 79. Bat had played beside these men often and occasionally had played opposite them when, as a special favor to a friend, he took a turn dealing for the house. Whether he sat on the outside or the inside, as bucking the bank or protecting it were called, respectively, he had always managed to play a good even game. Western gamblers in the late 1870s and early 1880s were not looked upon as necessarily belonging to an underworld society. On the contrary, gambling, as Bat pointed out in writing of Dodge, was not only the principal and best-paying industry of the town, but was considered among the most respectable. So, in February, after winding up his affairs in Dodge, Bat set out on the gambling trail. By now, two new camps had preempted Dodge's claim as mistress of the gamblers. Tombstone, Arizona, where Wyatt Earp had gone several months earlier, was one major port of call for the border sports. The other was the new silver camp of Leadville, Colorado, that blossoming flower for the nectar of which the Santa Fe and Rio Grande Railroads had battled in 1879. Bat had been there, of course, and knew many of his friends to be there, so that was his first destination. Leadville, in 1880, was a sporting man's delight. With regard to the number of gambling games running and the stakes involved, Dodge seemed tame in comparison. Even Cheyenne, at the time of the Deadwood Rush, did not match Leadville for a town gone gambling crazy. There was a game for every taste. Houses ranged from hastily constructed lean-tos to glittering temples of chance, and featured layouts for rondo, vintage poker, casino, keno, California Jack, Ercher, Chuck-a-Luck, Rogue-a-Noor, Lansquenet, and Paddle Wheel. But Faro was king in Leadville, as it was in most Western camps. Betting limits in Dodge City Faro spreads had rarely been raised beyond $25 a card. In Leadville, the banks set no limit, and bets of $1,000 or $5,000 on the turn of a card were common. Bat visited the California Concert Hall, operated by Jeff Winnie, where Kitty Crawhurst, one of the first and best of the lady gamblers, presided over a faro table. The Board of Trade Saloon, specializing in stud poker, and the Texas House, run by Bailey Youngston and Little Con Featherly, a shrewd pair of Galveston gamblers. Genial, soft-spoken John Pentland was the chief dealer at the Texas House. It was said that he won $80,000 for the house during the first few months of its existence. All of these kingpins of Colorado gambling knew Masterson either personally or by reputation. They welcomed him to Leadville effusively and plied him with offers of jobs. Men with gunslinging reputations were employed in the gambling houses as dealers or lookouts to provide a restraining influence on those who tended to become violent when they lost. No one in Leadville carried a more formidable reputation than this former sheriff of Ford County, Kansas. Bat was offered wages substantially higher than the $6 or $7 a day run-of-the-mill dealers were receiving, but he was not yet ready to trade on his gunfighting renown. He declined all offers and limited his play to the outside. In early March, Bat returned to Dodge to serve as a delegate to the Ford County Republican Convention. Later that month, he attended the state convention in Topeka. His luck at Leadville apparently had been good, for at the conclusion of the convention, he told friends he was going back to Colorado with the intention of investing certain capital that he had accumulated in a saloon and gambling house of his own. Property values in Leadville had been sky high, so Bat headed for the booming Gunnison County in search of a saloon site. He explored Pitkin, Gunnison City, and Ruby City without success. When he returned to Dodge in June, he cautioned fellow Kansans against the terrors of winter in the Colorado mountain country. As late as May, he said, snow was still 3 feet deep in the streets of Ruby City. He was still in Dodge when Ben Thompson approached him for help. Brother Bill was in trouble again, and this time it looked as if Ben was powerless to help him. Ben had just received a wire from Ogallala, Nebraska, to the effect that Bully Bill had been shot up in a row with an Ogallala citizen and was in great danger of being lynched. Ben had been outlawed in Ogallala and could not go to Bill's aid. According to the information Ben had received, Thompson enemies in Nebraska were wrought up enough to welcome a double rope party. Ben wanted Bat to go to Ogallala and see what could be done to save Bill. Bat agreed to do so. Ogallala lay some 250 miles north and west of Dodge City. By a circuitous rail and stage route, Bat finally reached the dusty little cow town, which squatted on the main line of the Union Pacific on the north bank of the South Platte River. There were not more than 30 buildings in the whole town, most of them clustered in a one-block area along Railroad Avenue. At the Ogallala House, the only hotel, Bat found Bill Thompson propped up in bed with 5 shotgun pellets in him. Thompson had come to Ogallala for the cattle shipping season and had opened a Monte game in Bill Tucker's saloon, the Cowboys Rest. In the course of events, he and Tucker quarreled over the affections of Big Alice, a local harlot. Primed with booze in another saloon, Thompson entered the Cowboys Rest and fired a shot at Tucker, who was behind the bar. The owner was in the act of passing a glass of whiskey across the bar to cattleman Dylan Fant. Thompson's bullet smashed the glass and neatly sliced off the thumb and 3 fingers of Tucker's left hand. When the saloon men disappeared from sight behind the bar, Thompson, in his alcoholic haze, turned and pushed back out through the swinging doors, believing he had killed his man. But Tucker was not finished. He emerged from behind the bar, holding a 10-gauge sawed-off shotgun in his good hand. At the doorway, he steadied the barrel on his bleeding stump of a hand and let fly at the weaving form of Thompson, hitting him in the back with 5 pellets. After this exchange, the combatants retired to tend their wounds. Thompson to the hotel, Tucker to his home. Bat learned that although Thompson's wounds were serious, he would recover. I found Thompson laid up in bed in the hotel from the effects of several wounds he had received from Tucker, Bat wrote. I also found him under arrest with the deputy sheriff guarding him in his room. I concluded, with the view of bringing about an understanding between the two warriors, to go and see Tucker, whom I also found in bed at his home with his left hand, minus thumb and fingers, done up in liniment-soaked bandages. Bat was convinced that Tucker and his friends intended to stretch Thompson's neck as soon as he was well enough to be on his feet, but discreet inquiries revealed that Tucker would let bygones be bygones for a price. The sum, however, Bat said, was beyond the reach of Thompson and his friends. Therefore, my conference with the thumbless one was at an end. Bat set about formulating a plan for Thompson's escape. He instructed Bill to pretend greater pain and suffering than he actually felt. There were no doctors in Ogallala, and the extent of the Texan's injuries were not definitively known. Bat wanted to keep Thompson out of jail until he could work a way out to spirit him out of town. Meanwhile, Bat got on friendly terms with the guard, a young fellow who had lately reached the country from one of the New England states. His armament consisted of a long-barreled Colt's .45 caliber pistol with a white handle of which he seemed duly proud. Getting Thompson out of Ogallala proved to be quite a problem, Bat found. Although Thompson was not as badly injured as he let on to be, he had nevertheless been sufficiently crippled to be of little use to himself in case of emergency. Had Thompson been able to ride a horse, it would have been very easy for us to escape in that manner, but that was out of the question. If, on the other hand, we attempted to escape by wagon, we would be easily trailed and overtaken by the posse we knew would be soon in hot pursuit. There was, therefore, but one avenue of escape left to us, and that was the railroad. Some 50 miles east of the Union Pacific tracks lay North Platte, home of Colonel William F. Buffalo Bill Cody. Bat had met the celebrated scout in Dodge. He knew that Cody, who was spending a rare interlude at home, was always ready for a new adventure. He figured that if he could get Thompson to North Platte, Cody would help get the wounded Texan the rest of the way back to Dodge. The eastbound flyer stopped at Ogallala to fill its water tank about midnight before continuing on to its next stop at North Platte. Getting the crippled Thompson aboard that train was Bat's problem, and it was a difficult one. It seemed as if everybody in town was watching every move I made, and from what I subsequently heard, I am satisfied that they were. I had no sooner arrived in town than the sheriff, thinking perhaps that I might make an attempt to rescue his prisoner, issued the strictest kind of instructions to his deputy, who had been assigned to guard Thompson, to never leave the room for a moment while he was on duty, and I can truthfully say that he obeyed the instructions to the very letter. One Sunday night, however, there was a dance given by the people of the town, and as was the custom in those small western hamlets in those days, everybody in the place attended the blowout. The dance was given in the schoolhouse, which was used for church purposes whenever a preacher happened along that way. The building, which wasn't much larger than a good-sized hen coop, was situated on a little knoll about 400 yards north of the depot, which was located in the center of town. The sheriff, who was also the town fiddler, was furnishing the music for the occasion, and nearly everybody in Ogallala was at the dance. This was obviously my time for getting away with Thompson. Jim Dunn, the hotel bartender, was one of the few people who could not attend the shindig, having to remain on duty. Dunn had worked the Dodge City saloons and was a friend of Bat's, so he eagerly agreed to help when Bat asked him to join in the escape plot. Bat explained his plan, then went to Thompson's room. Thompson's hotel room faced the schoolhouse, and as the squeaking notes of the sheriff's fiddle drifted out over the prairie, Bat, standing at the open window, remarked to the young deputy on guard, "I am sorry I'm not at that dance, for they seem to be having a good time up there." The guard nodded glumly, and when Bat suggested having a drink, he readily agreed. Bat ordered two whiskey sours, which Jim Dunn delivered, winking slyly at Bat as the young deputy tossed his drink down. Bat sent Dunn back for refills. "Soon after, the deputy disposed of the second drink," wrote Bat. "He spread himself on the floor and was soon dreaming of his New England home." Jim Dunn was, as Bat put it, an artist in his business, and the Mickey Finn was a refinement of civilization not entirely unknown, even in an obscure frontier outpost like Ogallala. Bat dressed Thompson, hoisted him to his shoulders, and carried him down the steps and across to the depot. His timing was perfect. The train was grinding to a halt as he came hobbling up. Bat stumbled aboard, and in a few minutes, he and Bill Thompson were speeding at the rate of 40 miles an hour for North Platte, while the tired strains of Turkey in the Straw filled the empty streets of Ogallala. When the train pulled into North Platte, Bat heaved Thompson to his shoulder, climbed down onto the platform, and looked about for the nearest saloon. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, but Dave Perry's saloon was ablaze with lights. Bat kicked open the swinging doors and entered to find Colonel Cody surrounded by a ring of admirers, narrating one of his hair-raising adventures. "As a matter of course," wrote Bat, "we were given a royal welcome and were immediately taken in charge by Colonel Cody, who found a safe place for us to remain until he could outfit us for the trip across the country to Dodge City. The Ogallala authorities will not take you from here," said Cody to us that night, and we slept quite comfortably. The following day, Bat left Thompson to go to Cody's house, a beautiful place in the suburbs of North Platte, to arrange for a horse and rig for the journey south. When he arrived, he found Buffalo Bill out front erecting a flagpole in honor of General Hancock, who had just been nominated for presidency by the Democratic Party. It can be safely assumed that Cody received no help from Bat Masterson, a hardcore Republican. "I may here state that Buffalo Bill is a Democrat," wrote Bat, "but that should not be held against him, for he is a splendid fellow, and perhaps regrets it as much as any genuine American could." Cody gave Bat a big, strong Texas horse and a handsome new phaeton he had purchased recently for his wife. "If Bat were willing to wait in North Platte a day or two," said Cody, "he and Thompson could have company for part of their trip. General Sheridan was sending to Buffalo Bill's ranch a party of distinguished foreigners who wanted to see some of the wild and woolly West. Since 1871, when Bill had served as guide for Grand Duke Alexis of Russia and his retinue, European dignitaries had requested his services when touring the plains. Cody planned to take the visitors to Keith's ranch, a large cattle spread some 25 miles south of North Platte, and directly in Bat's route to Dodge. He suggested that they all travel together that far. Bat was agreeable, so he and Thompson remained in town until the foreigners arrived. There were fully 20 persons in that party, Bat recalled, and as everybody was feeling good when we left North Platte, the trip to Keith's was a right royal one, you may be sure. I was driving a double team hitched to Cody's specially made mess wagon, which was loaded down with everything imaginable. As noted by Bat, all members of the company were in high spirits, and their bibulous host saw to it that no one lost that fine edge because of thirst. He had arranged for periodic rest stops during which bottles were passed freely among the convivial travelers. The caravan would stop every little while and liquor up, Bat said, and then go on until the next liquoring up point was reached, when the caravan would again come to a halt. The combination of alcohol, hot July sun, and jouncing ride affected everyone, even that veteran tippler, Colonel Cody himself. Bill, sagging in his saddle, finally pulled over beside Bat's mess wagon and flopped in, sound asleep. Bat was having trouble focusing his eyes on the trail ahead, and thereby hangs the tale. We had gone only a short distance after Bill had fallen asleep when the wagon was tipped completely upside down. I was pitched out on my head in the prairie, while Cody was buried beneath the wagon and its contents. I gathered myself up as quickly as I could and got hold of the horses by the head and held them until other members of the party came and rescued Cody, who hadn't received as much as a scratch, while I had my lower lip nearly torn from my face. The travelers arrived at Keith's ranch without further mishap, and after cleaning up a bit, sat down together to enjoy a hearty Western-style meal. After supper, Buffalo Bill, always the showman, entertained the foreigners with feats of horsemanship and marksmanship. The stunts he did, marveled Bat, were nothing short of wonderful. The next day, Bat and Bill Thompson bade farewell to Colonel Cody and his guests and headed for Dodge City in the Phaeton. Mrs. Cody unknowingly had donated to them. Bat saw Buffalo Bill several years later, and the latter told him he had some tall explaining to do when he returned home and his wife questioned him about the strange disappearance of her prized carriage. Cody was making plenty of money, however, and a new and more elegant vehicle soon was purchased to replace the Phaeton. Shortly after Bill Thompson and Bat left Keith's, ominous black clouds rolled out of the west, and they were soon driving their topless vehicle through heavy rain that continued for the entire trip of more than 200 miles. Bill Thompson and his deliverer were a sorry spectacle when they finally wheeled into Dodge. Swathed in bandages and very weak, the bad boy from Texas was huddled in a chilled, sodden ball under a buffalo robe. The former sheriff, his lips severely lacerated, held the reins in numbed hands. Both were mud-splattered and rain-soaked from head to foot. But Bat wanted a couple of good, stiff drinks, a hot meal, a bath, and about 10 hours of uninterrupted sleep. But Thompson insisted that they first go to the telegraph office. There, Bully Bill dispatched a wire to the sheriff at Ogallala, notifying him of his safe arrival and inviting him to come and get him in case he still thought he wanted him. Added Bat, the fiddling sheriff made no reply to Thompson's message, and there the matter ended. Epilogue. Tributes to Bat Masterson poured into the New York Morning Telegraph and were received by Bat's widow from all parts of the country when he died October 25, 1921. Spokesmen for the world of sports in particular expressed a deep sense of loss. Hundreds of Bat's friends and admirers gathered at the funeral home for the services, and William Muldoon, New York boxing commissioner, rose and delivered a tribute that he said was no attempt at oratory, no studied eulogium, but an honest appraisal of Bat Masterson as a friend. During 40 years of intimate friendship, said Muldoon, he had never known Bat Masterson to do a dishonorable deed, never to betray a friend, never to convive a dishonor, and never to fear an enemy. True West Magazine, August 2000 edition. Here's the column, Ask the Marshal, by Marshall Trimble. Question. I have a question that maybe you can answer. Why isn't Morgan Earp listed on the Arizona Lawman Memorial at Wesley Boland Plaza in Phoenix, Arizona? Steve Wahlberg, Phoenix, Arizona. Answer. Morgan Earp isn't listed on the Arizona Peace Officer Memorial because he wasn't acting in the line of duty when he was killed while shooting pool in Campbell and Hatch's saloon in Tombstone on March 18, 1882. And more importantly, he wasn't a lawman at the time of his murder. Question. I've heard being a cowboy was a dangerous occupation. How did most cowboys meet their maker? Danny Diaz, Louisville, Kentucky. Answer. Contrary to popular myth, very few cowboys died from gunshot wounds. Most died from horse-related accidents. The most dangerous part of the trail drives was crossing swollen rivers. It was so dangerous that a popular way to say a cowhand was dependable in a crunch was to say he was a good man to ride the river with. Surprisingly, a large number of cowhands died from prostate cancer. Years of butt-pounding on the back of a horse took its toll. Question. What's the difference between shotgun and batwing chaps? Larry Mason, Severn, Maryland. Answer. Shotgun chaps fit tight around the legs like an extra pair of jeans and look like twin barrels of a shotgun. They can be buttoned, but are usually fastened with a long zipper. Batwing chaps had wide flapping leggings or wings and were snapped on. Both were decorated with nickel or silver conchas and leather rosettes. Question. Why did cattle drive cooks throw their dirty dishwater under the chuck wagon? Mike Lumman, Colorado Springs, Colorado. It was a tradition among cocineros, or cookies, to toss the dishwater under the chuck wagon to discourage cowhands from sneaking under there for a quick nap in the shade, thus protecting the cook's domain. Question. How many battles did the U.S. Army fight against Western Indians? Finley Harper, Gallup, New Mexico. Answer. According to Francis Heitman's Historical Register and Directory of the United States Army, there were 1,240 engagements, excluding the Civil War. 2,125 soldiers were killed, including Custer's 250 and Fetterman's 90. It's estimated that some 3,000 Indian warriors also died. Total soldier civilians killed in the West is estimated at 7,000, and the total Indians killed is estimated at 4,000. Figures say it cost the government about $1 million for each Indian killed.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.